You know, Gail and I helped plant a church years ago down in Bluffton, South Carolina, and the organization that worked with us kind of made sure and helped us send 15,000 mailings, postcards, four different times to the people in our community. So we designed these postcards with hopefully kind of fun or clever pictures with catchy wording. We wanted to get people's attention. If they would read the information, hopefully they would come visit our new church. And so one time we had a picture of a neighbor's boy that I took, and there with the flag, and we were going to be having a 9/11 memorial service. One of the pictures was of a friend of mine's son looking down into the water, and he's looking at his reflection, and we just talked about everybody's search for meaning and purpose in life. I had a picture I took of my daughter when she was a little girl, and the whole idea was, are you kind of looking for something to do? Are you looking for something to fill up your time or that would be meaningful? And then to highlight our children's ministry, I had this picture of these kids running down a hill and just the look of joy and excitement on their faces. And it was the whole idea of, you know, promoting what we had for kids. But on the back of that postcard, the first line of the message said, "It's a scientific fact that if your parents don't have children, there's at least an 87% chance that you won't have children either." Now, I want you to think about that for just a minute, okay? If your parents don't have children, there's at least an 87% chance that you won't have children either. In fact, there's a 100% chance that you won't have children either because you're not going to be here, right? It was a touch of humor to see who was paying attention. I got at least three messages back from the community from people saying something like, "I think you made a mistake on that postcard. You know, if your parents don't have kids, well, then you're not going to be born," which I wanted to say, don't you know the meaning of irony? And maybe you'd enjoy the Baptist church. You know, I mean, I don't know. I didn't say that. I politely apologize for my lame attempt at humor. It was obviously over their heads. And I'm thinking, if you had children, maybe you've lowered the IQ of the gene pool. But anyway, that's not important right now. I invited them to church anyway. But the truth is, listen, if you have been born, you have parents, okay? Biologically, that's just the way it works. If you're here, you had a mom and a dad. Whether they stuck with it or not, I don't know, all right? And when some of you think about your parents, man, it's nothing but fond memories. Your parents were fun. They were wise. They were firm but nurturing. And you know what? Others of you look back with nothing but pain. And maybe scars for you are physical. Maybe scars for you are emotional, but your parents hurt you deeply. For those of you who are still living at home, your parents might seem harsh to you. They might seem too demanding to you. Maybe you think they're a little slow and out of touch. It's going to be amazing how much smarter they're going to get when you turn about 25. I mean, it just happens. All of a sudden, you realize they're pretty smart after all. Just give them some time. But the thing is, all of us have to relate to our parents, or we have to relate to the memory of our parents. If you're under 18, that relationship looks different than it does at 30. In fact, I think too many parents make the mistake of trying to be their son or daughter's best friend when what their child needs early on is the guiding hand of a godly mom and dad. There's plenty of time for friendship later on. Our kids are in their early 30s now, and man, they are among our very best friends. But 20 years ago, that relationship looked different. It had to for it to be healthy. At the same time, Gail and I find ourselves at a place where many of you do, where you've got grown kids, maybe grandkids, but you've also still got your parents. And there's that stage of life where you're trying to figure out how to care the best for them. My parents are among my best friends too. But still, there's this inevitable role reversal that takes place if your parents live long enough. All of this is to say that we are tackling a very broad subject today. In this series, relatively speaking, this idea of relating to our relatives, how we relate to our parents, the relatives that we've known the longest, is a fairly vast subject to deal with. Unless you shared the womb with a twin, your mom, and then hopefully shortly after your birth, your dad, became the people that you have known the longest in the world. And if those memories only bring pain, because of the poor job they did, or because they abandoned you, or because they died far too young, then please know that God feels your pain, that He is there in the mess with you, and that He is a perfect Father for you. I simply ask today that we all walk through this subject together, that we look for any kind of insight we might discover that could be helpful. And I at least ask, if nothing else, that you pray for other people in our church who are struggling, even if you feel like this doesn't apply to you. We began our series last week with the idea that we need to relate well with ourselves before we're ready to relate well with anybody else. We talked about integrity last week, and we said that if we can't be honest with ourselves, how can we be honest in any of our other relationships? We're using Jacob in the Old Testament to be our guide for this series. And if you remember, Jacob was the son of Isaac and Rebekah. He was the grandson of Abraham and Sarah. He's the husband of Rachel and Leah. He's the father of the 12 patriarchs, the 12 tribal leaders of Israel. In fact, what was Jacob's name changed to? Anybody? Changed to Israel, exactly. And thus we talk about the children of Israel, the tribes of Israel. Well, last week's word, the key point was integrity. I want to talk to you today about duty. The duty that we have to honor our father and our mother. That's the fifth of the Ten Commandments. And even though the Ten Commandments were not written yet, given by God yet, when Jacob was relating to his parents, Isaac and Rebekah, there was still an expectation. There was still a duty for him to honor the relatives who were closest to him. And truthfully, Jacob set a pretty poor example of that early in life. Hopefully, he got better later on. But I want to show you how Jacob related to his mom and his dad, and then later his father-in-law, Laban. And then we're going to talk about the four duties that we have with our own moms and dads. You remember what we learned last week about Jacob's name? The Hebrew word for Jacob literally means he who grasps the heel. In other words, he who trips someone intentionally. And thus the word came to mean he who takes someone else's place by force or by treachery. It was the idea of supplanting someone, taking what was theirs. Just very simply, Jacob means deceiver. And if you named your child Jacob, I know you weren't thinking that, but that was a label in this time for him. Now, what did Jacob do, or what was he about to do, that would earn him a label like that? Well, listen to Genesis 27, the first four verses. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so weak that he could no longer see, he called for Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." "Here I am," he answered. Isaac said, "I am now an old man, and I don't know the day of my death. Now then, get your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare me the kind of tasty food I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my blessing before I die." See, Isaac knew that his life was winding down. He was blind. His days were numbered. And so he called Esau, his firstborn son, and he said to him, "I want you to go hunting. I want you to make me some supper. Then I'm going to give you the special blessing before I die." And this is what Esau had been counting on. The testamentary blessing from a father to his son. The final blessing that was a binding covenant. It was like a will that was ratified. Once it was spoken, it could not be undone. It was irrevocable. And so Esau went looking for game, eager to receive his father's ultimate blessing. Only Jacob's mom, Rebekah, overheard what Isaac had said to Esau, and the wheel started turning in her mind, and she came up with a scheme to trick Isaac. In verse 8, she said to Jacob, "Listen carefully and do what I tell you." She told Jacob to dress up in Esau's clothes, to put goat skin on his hands and his neck because Esau was hairy. And if Isaac touched him, he would feel hairy. And then they would cook a meal just the way Isaac liked it. And then Jacob would go into his father. He would claim to be Esau. Isaac would smell Esau's clothes. He would eat the food just the way Esau would have prepared it. He would touch Jacob's arms and it would feel like Esau's arms did. And even though all this was Rebekah's idea, Jacob went along with it. He was an adult. He had every opportunity to say, no, that's a terrible idea. But he just did exactly what she said. He went into his father. He lied about who he was. He deceived his dad. Ultimately, he robbed Esau of what was rightfully his. Now, we're going to talk next week about Jacob and Esau and this whole topic of relating to siblings. But right now, I just want you to see that because of Jacob's deceit, Isaac thought he was Esau, thought he was talking to Esau, and so he gave Jacob that final covenant blessing. And then when Esau came in a little while later to be blessed, the father and son realized they had been duped, right? It was too late. Nothing could be done. Jacob did not work his way to the top. He deceived his way to the top. Isaac and Esau had been betrayed. And that's partly why Jacob ran off 500 miles to Haran to find a wife. It's partly why he stayed there for 20 years. His dad was mad and his brother wanted to kill him. Jacob the deceiver had lived up to his name. Now when Jacob got to Haran, he met his cousin Rachel and he fell desperately in love with her. It kind of sounds like Kentucky. If we get divorced, are we still cousins? But you know what I mean. Okay, so I'm from Kentucky. It's all right. Jacob ended up marrying both Rachel and her sister Leah, and that's a story for another day as well. But the key here is that Jacob gained a very strong, a very prosperous, and a fairly deceitful father-in-law named Laban. Laban was Rebekah's brother. And so Jacob worked for his uncle Laban for 20 years. The first 14 years were to pay Laban for the honor of marrying his daughters. The other 6 years, God richly blessed Jacob through the expansion of his flocks and herds. See, Laban had made a deal with Jacob that Jacob could keep all of the speckled or the spotted sheep and goats that were born into the herd. But Laban never dreamed how many that would be. The scripture says that God just made that happen over and over. And Jacob just essentially took what was Laban's or what had been. And Laban got mad about it. So Genesis 31 verse 4. Jacob sent word to Rachel and Leah to come out to the fields where his flocks were. He said to them, I see that your father's attitude toward me is not what it was before, but the God of my father has been with me. You know that I've worked for your father with all my strength, and yet your father has cheated me by changing my wages 10 times. However, God has not allowed him to harm me. If Laban said, the speckled ones will be your wages, then all the flocks gave birth to speckled young. And if Laban said, the streaked ones will be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked young. God has taken away your father's livestock and has given them to me. Now Jacob went on to tell his wives that God said it was time to go home. And so he gathered up Leah and Rachel and all their sons and their servants and the flocks and herds, and they set off for Canaan, only they did not tell Laban they were leaving. He was out of town. They kind of snuck away. Now, that was not part of God's instructions. Jacob came up with that on his own. Notice what it says in Genesis 31, 20. Jacob deceived Laban, the Aramean, by not telling him that he was running away. Well, Laban got back home. He found out about it, none too happy, as you might imagine. So he gathered up his posse, and he set off after them. Took him 7 days to catch up because Jacob and his family had such a head start. But Laban did catch up with him. And then Genesis 31, 26 says this. Laban said to Jacob, what have you done? You've deceived me. You've carried off my daughters like captives in war. Why did you run off secretly and deceive me? Why didn't you tell me so I could send you away with joy and singing and music of tambourines and harps? You didn't even let me kiss my grandchildren and my daughters goodbye. You have done a very foolish thing. Now, Jacob kind of defended himself back to Laban. He talked about how treacherous Laban had been with him over the years. He said he was afraid that Laban would try to keep his daughters and his grandchildren there and not allow them to go back to Haran with Jacob. Jacob stole away while Laban was out of town. And Laban said in verse 29, I have the power to harm you. But last night, the God of your father said to me, be careful not to say anything to Jacob, either good or bad. In other words, you leave Jacob alone. And so Laban confronted Jacob rather than attacking him. And then take a look at how this kind of wraps up in Genesis 31:51. Laban also said to Jacob, here is this heap of stones. Okay, he made a big pile of stones. He said, here's a pillar that I've set up between you and me. This heap is a witness, this pillar is a witness that I will not go past this heap to your side to harm you, and you will not go past this heap of stones and this pillar to come to my side and harm me. And may the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. And this is an interesting phrase. It says, so Jacob took an oath in the name of the fear of his father Isaac. The New Living Translation says, Jacob took an oath before the fearsome God of his father Isaac. It's like I get the feeling that Jacob wasn't quite sure yet how he feels about God. But he knew that his father Isaac feared God, and so he appealed to his father's faith. He sacrificed to his father's God. And I wonder if there's a lesson here for us. You may not agree with your parents' faith, but you can still be respectful of it. You may have doubts about God or about Jesus, but you can still be humble as you deal with them. And then verse 55 concludes here. Early the next morning, Laban kissed his grandchildren and his daughters, and he blessed them. And then he left and returned home. And Jacob returned home too, only not home where Laban was. He returned home where he had come from, back to Canaan. He even got to see his father Isaac still alive after all these years, because Genesis 35 says Isaac died old and full of years. Truth is, the story of Jacob is a convoluted one, and we're going to kind of bounce in and out of the story during these 6 weeks of our study. But we see here that he listened to his mom, he tricked his dad, he had a dubious relationship with his father-in-law, and then he outlived all of them by a good many years. But what kind of lessons can we learn from this story about how we relate to our parents, relatively speaking? And the first thing I want to suggest to you is that we have a duty to obey them. Ironically, Jacob obeyed his mom even though she had a horrible idea. He essentially disobeyed his dad when he tricked him and lied to him. Later, he obeyed both of them when they said, you really ought to go choose a wife from back in our homeland, 500 miles away. And then he honored his parents' wishes later in life when he buried them where they asked to be buried. But this idea of obedience is crucial when it comes to parents, especially for children growing up in their parents' house. If you are a child or a teenager, this has to do with things like chores, with things like curfews. It has to do with the kind of rules they give. It has to do with cleaning your room and putting your phone away when they say that's enough. It's about doing what you're told, but also not doing what you know is wrong, even if they haven't said anything about it. See, the thing is, unless they're asking you to do something that's immoral or illegal, they get to make the rules. Someday when you have your own house and your own kids, you're going to get to make the rules. And you're going to find out how fun it is to be in charge and to be unpopular. Okay, you'll discover that for yourself. If you're a teenager living at home, seriously, I want to ask you a question, okay? What if I could make your life easier, I could make your life more comfortable, and I could make your life less stressful, and you would not have to do any more work than you already have to do? Does that sound good? You interested in that? All you have to do is anticipate what your parents are going to make you do and do it before they ask. I mean, they're going to make you do it anyway if they're good parents. If you anticipate it and do it before they ask you, you're going to be way, way, way on their good side. Bob Russell shared a scenario years ago. I just love this. He said, let's say you're 16 years old. You go out with some friends on Friday night. Your mom says, I want you home by 11:30. You come sneaking in after midnight. She's waiting up for you, and the situation kind of escalates into an argument, and you know, you don't trust me, and she says, well, you're not responsible, and it goes back and forth, and then you slam your door, and you go to bed the next morning at 9 o'clock. She opens the door. She barks, get up and clean up this pigsty. And you lay there another half an hour. She hollers at you three more times. Finally, you stumble out of bed. You throw a few things in drawers. You slam every drawer. And she says, turn that music down, and you turn it up. She says, it's time for lunch, and you come in, you eat about three bites, and you leave the table, and it's tense all day, and everybody's in a bad mood, and you spend most of your time on the phone telling your friends what it's like to live with Adolf Hitler's sister. Okay, just that kind of day. About supper time, you say to your mom, hey, Mom, some friends are going out to the movies tonight. I'd like to go, but I don't have any money. Can I have $20? And she says, are you crazy? All day long. We have been in a battle. You come in late last night, you pouted all day, and now you ask me for $20 to go to the movies? Do you think I've lost my mind? Don't answer that. And it's just bam, bam. You're going to stay home tonight and crochet a blanket for Grandma. You're not going anywhere. Now, think about this. Seriously, you think about what it would be like if you handled that situation differently. It's Friday night, and you come in just after 11, and Mom says, is anything wrong? It's not 11:30 yet. You say, no, I just thought I'd come in early. Maybe we can watch a Hallmark movie together. And the next morning, you get up and you straighten your room without being asked. And you take down that poster your mom hates. And then you put a Celine Dion CD on. And then you go out and mow the lawn because you don't want to be inside listening to Celine Dion. About supper time, you say to your mom, some of my friends are going out tonight going to the movies. I don't have any money. If you think I need to stay home, that's fine. But I'd sure like to go. And she says, oh, honey, let me give you $80 so you can take your friends. I don't know how you stretch your allowance as far as you do. And you say, now that's kind of unrealistic, and you're probably right. You're probably right. But there is a principle here. Obedience paves the way for greater freedom, for a smoother life, and for the blessing of God. It paves the way for that. And when you anticipate what they're going to ask you to do anyway, you are miles ahead when it comes to a happy life. Miles ahead. It is your duty to obey your mom and dad, like it or not. And I would say to you too, if you are a minor, now so let me try that again. If you are not a minor anymore, if you are over 18 and you're still living at home, you're still living on your parents' dime under their roof, you've still got a responsibility to honor their wishes. If you don't like it, you can move out. Okay, number two. We have a duty to respect them. Now, this goes for when you're a kid living at home. It also goes for when you go off to college, when you're living out on your own, when you've got your own kids, even your own grandkids. We have a responsibility to respect our parents. What did God tell Moses in the Ten Commandments? Honor your father and mother. Don't just tolerate them. Don't just kind of grudgingly obey them. Respect the job they have to do or the job that they have done. Respect the fact that kids don't come with a set of operating instructions, that mom and dad have been in over their head most of your life, and they can Google child rearing questions all they want, but in the heat of a battle, it's hard to reflect back on what those professionals had to say. I remember when I was in high school, I did not have a curfew. My parents trusted me. They did not give me an exact time to be home. Only one night, I came in so late that I knew it was too late, just like they knew it was too late. And I'm just thinking, I hope everybody's asleep when I get home. And I walk in, and everybody was asleep except my mom, who was sitting in the living room waiting for me. And after, you know, all the where have you beens and all the what have you been up to's, she said, I think you need to have Ann home by midnight. Ann was my girlfriend at that time. And I said, I don't think that's up to you. Her mom and dad did not give her a curfew, which in retrospect was not the smartest thing that I ever said to my mom. My mom was a smart woman, and she said, okay, you have to be home by midnight. And I was smart enough to realize that means I got to have Ann home by 11:30 now instead of 12, where it was about a minute and a half ago, because she lived a half hour away. My disrespect is not scoring me any points here, even if I might win in a court of law. You know, I mean, if only I had had a wise preacher in 1982 who would have shared this message with me. Anyway, okay. Yeah, I was pretty disrespectful that night, and I paid the consequences. Respect is how we talk to our parents, how we engage with them. When we're teenagers, sure, but also when we're adults. We grow up, they begin to age. When you're an adult, you don't always want your parents' advice. I get that. But if you ask for their advice when you can, even if you don't follow their suggestions, it says to them that you care what they think. If you can't answer the phone every time they call, you can call them back. You can return texts. Parents aren't just free babysitters. You can go see them because you want to see them as well. You know, when your parents get older, they're going to maybe start repeating stories, and they're going to ask the same questions over and over again. And maybe it'd be good to remember all the times they had to get up with you in the night when you were little, all the times they had to change your diaper when it was really inconvenient, how many times they watched that same Disney movie over and over and over and over again. And when you have to walk slowly with them, remember how slow they had to walk when they taught you how to walk in the first place. May I just say that when you were 2 years old, you were a pain in the neck. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you were, and most parents are pretty patient when it comes to babies and toddlers. We owe our parents the same courtesy. And maybe you're thinking, yeah, but I was a lot cuter then than my dad is now. And you're right. That's why it's a duty to do this, because it's not always easy. But it is our responsibility. It's about how we relate to our parents. I was thinking about Jacob and the Bible story here. It would have been so much more respectful to both Isaac and Rebekah if Jacob told his mom, no, I'm not going to deceive my dad. See, he would have respected both of them by doing that. I'm not going to do something as unethical as that. If instead of going along with Rebekah's idea, that would have been the more respectful thing. He didn't respect her by doing that. He dishonored both of them. And I think the same is true here with Laban. Laban had many faults, but when Jacob left, he disrespected his father-in-law by sneaking away. He convinced his wives to disrespect their dad, and he caused all kinds of trouble. And frankly, he put his whole family in danger. If God had not intervened, there's no telling what Laban might have done. Respect is a duty. But now here's the third thing. We have a duty to care for our parents. And we've touched on this already. I just want to make sure I include it on our list. There often comes a time later in life when we have to make sure our parents feel safe. They feel valued. They're as comfortable as possible. Now, some parents refuse to be content. I understand. But we owe them our care the best that we can manage. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul wrote this in 1 Timothy 5, verse 3. He said, take care of any widow who has no one else to care for her. But if she has children or grandchildren, their first responsibility is to show godliness at home and repay their parents by taking care of them. This is something that pleases God. And then you drop down to verse 8. Those who won't care for their relatives, especially those in their own household, have denied the true faith. Such people are worse than unbelievers. See, care for aging parents is our first responsibility in the family. And maybe that means that you have to drive your parents to the doctor or to the grocery, and that's inconvenient, and it probably means at some point that you've taken their keys away. And that's hard. That's why we talked about respect before we got to this, about how we care for them. When hard decisions like that have to be made, we need to do it gently, and we do it respectfully. Maybe they can't live by themselves anymore. They move in with you, or they move into assisted living, or they end up needing nursing home care. And friends, I want to be honest with you. Man, I've been doing ministry for 38 years. And I can't tell you how many times somebody has said to me, my mom, my dad said, if you love me, you will never put me in a nursing home. That is unconscionable. I know that there probably are kids who dump their parents off somewhere and never go see them again. But I'm going to tell you something. I don't know of a time in the families I've worked with where that's been the case. Instead, it has been a gut-wrenching, last resort decision. And if you lay that kind of guilt trip on your kids, it is not fair. Respect goes both ways. Okay. There's one more thing I want to say when it comes to duty with our parents, and that we have a duty to forgive them. Listen, I know many of you had great parents, or you had them, and your memories, man, there's just love and faithfulness and godliness all there. But there are others, maybe many others, who carry around all this baggage. And I just want to remind you that as followers of Jesus, we are called to forgive. We forgive our friends and neighbors. Yeah, that's not so hard. But we're also supposed to forgive our enemies. And Jesus says, you know, it's pretty easy to forgive the people that you love. It's harder to forgive those who've hurt you deeply. But that's when it really counts the most. See, here's the thing. Forgiveness doesn't mean that we let people off the hook. It doesn't mean that we allow them to escape consequences. It doesn't mean that we automatically trust them again. It doesn't mean that we perpetuate injustice. To forgive is just the healthiest, the bravest, the most Christ-like thing we can do. We forgive so we can sleep at night. We forgive so we can find peace. We forgive so that we can experience the forgiveness of God. Have you heard that old line, bitterness is like swallowing poison and waiting for the other person to die? It only hurts us. And look, I'm not making light of your pain. You might need to talk to a friend and really open up about what your past was like. You might need to talk to a counselor. That might be the best thing you could do. But we need to deal with our past. We need to let it go the best we can if we want to experience peace. If you're harboring hatred, I'm telling you, it's going to destroy your life. So when it comes to parents, it's our duty to obey them when we're young, to care for them when they're old, to respect them when we can, and to forgive them when we can't. All week long, I've been thinking, what's going to be the bottom line? I thought about, so your parents aren't perfect, you're not so hot yourself. But I decided that wasn't quite the tone that I was going for. The problem is, how do you have a bottom line when some people have great parents, other people have horrible parents? How do you say one thing to everybody when maybe you love your parents, maybe not so much? So here's what I came to. Parents need grace just like everybody else. Parents need grace just like everybody else. If you have or had the very best parents in the world, you need to remember they're only saved by grace. They're not perfect. It's only because of what God did for them. And man, if you had the very worst parents in the world, they need grace. They need your grace. And God knows they need His grace. All of us need grace. Parents need it just like everybody else. Yesterday afternoon, I went to Fern Creek Christian Church to a celebration of life service for Betty Richardson. Betty's husband, Melvin, was the chairman of the elders when I was the preacher there years ago. And he died a few years back, and now they're together in heaven. They're just such a wonderful, godly couple. And I learned something yesterday that in all my years of knowing them, I never knew. In fact, probably almost nobody in our church ever knew until their son told it yesterday. Two times early in the history of that church, Melvin and Betty mortgaged their house to keep the doors of the church open. They loved God so much, and they loved that little church so much, that they sacrificed everything they possibly could to make sure that the church stayed alive. And it just reminded me that everybody has a story, that everybody has a past, that people have done things and experienced things and maybe sacrificed things that the rest of us are never going to know about. And maybe some people have been through some horrible things. And maybe some people have been pretty horrible because of what they experienced. Everybody has a past. And it's why we need to remember that everybody needs grace, especially parents, because it's a tough job. There's a lot of good in the world. There's a lot of bad in the world. Man, aren't you glad for grace? Let's pray. Father in heaven, you are our perfect Father. We believe that, we trust that, we cling to that. But you have delegated certain responsibilities to moms and dads. And some of them have done that really, really well, and others not so well. But God, we have a responsibility as sons and daughters to relate to them in a way that honors you. And so I pray that you'd help us to obey when it's time to obey and to respect and to offer care to them when they need it and to forgive them when they need it. God, give us courage to live the kinds of lives and to build the kinds of families that will bring you honor. And we just pray all this today in Jesus' name. Amen.